This is podcast number 30 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm sharing lessons from George Washington. The American history topic for month 4 is George Washington, one man of virtue. In today's world, the word virtue has primarily been connected with sexual purity. But if you go back to Webster's 1828 dictionary, the word is so much richer in meaning. Virtue, Webster says, is nothing but voluntary obedience to truth. It means strength and moral goodness, but it doesn't stop there. It is that strength by which a person acts and produces effects on other bodies. A virtuous person lifts all around him. Virtue is the perfect word for George Washington. Who else could have held together a starving, ragtag army of merchants and farmers against the greatest military force in the world? Washington was a man of few words, but when he spoke, everyone listened. Insurmountable odds could not crush him, and power could not corrupt him. Do you remember what Dr. Gordon Neufeld said about the young attaching to someone and growing to be like that to which it has attached? It's fitting that Washington, who had no children of his own, should come to be known as the father of our country. When he is held up as an ideal to our children, by virtue of his goodness, they will want to grow up to be like him. And if the ideals of Washington become America's ideals, what a nation we would have, for we would be a people of faith, compassion, humility, mercy, duty, selfless determination, honesty, and have a tremendous love of home and family. Each of us must reconstruct him in our hearts before we can truly see the man he was. If you listen to the podcast about Plutarch, I talked about how Plutarch understood it wasn't in the battlefield or the big events that the heart of a great man is revealed, but in the small, seemingly insignificant acts. I would like to add some brushstrokes to this canvas you are painting in your heart of this great general, our first president and loving husband, so that you can see him clearly and by his virtue be lifted and strengthened where you stand. I've chosen some lesser-known events that illustrate his character, little scenes from his life taken from a 1911 book compiled by Wayne Whipple called The Story Life of Washington, A Life History in 500 True Stories, selected from original sources and fitted together in order. Don't you love those long, old titles? I'll link it in the podcast notes, and you can also find it in the F4 online library. Scene 1. Once the general was engaged in earnest consultation with Colonel Pickering until after night had fairly set in. Washington prepared to stay with the colonel overnight, provided he had a spare blanket and straw. "Oh, yes," said Primus, who was appealed to, "plenty of straw and blankets, plenty." In the middle of the night, Washington awoke. He looked about him and descried the Negro. He gazed at him a while and then spoke. "Primus," said he, "Primus." Primus started up and rubbed his eyes. "What, General?" said he. Washington rose up in his bed. "Primus," said he, "what do you mean by saying you had blankets and straw enough? Here you have given up your blankets and straw to me, that I may sleep comfortably while you are obliged to sit through the night." "It's nothing, General," said Primus. "It's nothing. I'm well enough. Don't trouble yourself about me, General, but go to sleep again. No matter about me. I sleep very good." "It is matters," said Washington. "I cannot do it, Primus. If either is to sit up, I will. But I think there is no need of either sitting up. The blanket is wide enough for two. Come and lie down with me." "Oh, no, General," said Primus, starting and protesting against the proposition. "No, let me sit here." "I say come and lie down here," said Washington. "There is room for both. I insist upon it." He threw open the blanket as he spoke and moved to one side of the straw. Primus professed to have been exceedingly shocked at the idea of lying under the same covering with the commander-in-chief, but his tone was so resolute and determined that he could not hesitate. He prepared himself, therefore, and laid himself down by Washington on the same straw under the same blanket, and the general and the negro slept until morning. Scene 2. 2 days before the Battle of Brandywine, Washington called to Morris's office in Philadelphia and said that they were so far in arrears with soldiers' pay and that men were in such hardships that they had little heart for battle. "Can you help us?" pleaded the commander-in-chief in a voice husky with emotion. Morris shook his head sadly, saying, "I have used up my own means and credit. I am deeply grieved to admit that I can do nothing now, nothing." General Washington, covering his face with his large hands so that the fingers touched his forehead, burst into an abandon of weeping, and as he sat there sobbing, the tears trickled through his fingers and dropped down his wrists. The general soon gained his normal composure, arose, and went without a word. The financier also got up and silently followed him, looking sadly after Washington as he passed slowly down the street. 2 days later, September 11, 1777, Washington met Lord Howe at Brandywine and was defeated. Scene 3. One day a Tory who was well known in his neighborhood was captured and brought into camp. His name was Michael Whitman, and he was accused of having carried aid and information to the British in Philadelphia. He was taken to Westchester and there tried by court-martial. It was proved that he was a very dangerous man and that he had more than once attempted to do great harm to the American army. He was pronounced guilty of being a spy and sentenced to be hanged. On the evening of the day before that set for the execution, a strange old man appeared in Valley Forge. He was a small man with long, snow-white hair falling over his shoulders. His face, although full of kindliness, was sad-looking and thoughtful. His eyes, which were bright and sharp, were upon the ground and lifted only when he was speaking. His name was announced. "Peter Miller," said Washington. "Certainly. Show him in at once." The old man went in. "General Washington, I have come to ask a great favor of you," he said in his usual kindly tones. "I shall be glad to grant you almost anything," said Washington, "for we surely are indebted to you for many favors. Tell me what it is." "I hear," said Peter, "that Michael Whitman has been found guilty of treason and that he is to be hanged at Turk's Head tomorrow. I have come to ask you to pardon him." Washington started back, and a cloud came over his face. "That is impossible," he said. "Whitman is a bad man. He has done all in his power to betray us. He has even offered to join the British in aid in destroying us. In these times, we dare not be lenient with traitors, and for that reason, I cannot pardon your friend." "Friend," cried Peter. "Why, he's no friend of mine. He's my bitterest enemy. He has persecuted me for years. He has even beaten me and spit in my face, knowing full well that I would not strike back. Michael Whitman is no friend of mine." Washington was puzzled. "And still you wish me to pardon him?" he asked. "I do," answered Peter. "I ask it of you as a great personal favor." "Tell me," said Washington with hesitating voice, "why is it that you thus ask the pardon of your worst enemy?" "I ask it because Jesus did as much for me," was the old man's brief answer. Washington turned away and went into another room. Soon he returned with a paper on which was written the pardon of Michael Whitman. "My dear friend," he said, as he placed it in the old man's hands, "I thank you for this example of Christian charity." It was a matter of 15 miles by the shortest road from Valley Forge to Westchester, which was then known as Turk's Head, and the road at the time was almost impassable. The evening was already far gone, and Michael Whitman was to be hanged at sunrise in the morning. How was the pardon to reach him in time to save his life? Old and feeble though he was, he began to run. From the top of the hill a welcome sight appeared. The straggling village of Turk's Head was just before him, and the sun had not yet risen. He saw a commotion in the street. Men were hurrying toward the village green. A body of soldiers was already there, drawn up in order beneath a tree. Summoning all his strength, Peter ran on and soon entered the village. Close to the tree stood Michael Whitman with his hands tied behind him. A strong rope was dangling from one of the branches. In another minute, the sun would begin to peep over the snow-clad hills. An officer had already given orders to place the rope around the traitor's neck. Peter Miller, still running, shouted with all his might. The officer heard and paused. The crowd looked around and wondered. Panting and out of breath, Peter came up, waving a paper in his hand. "A pardon! A pardon!" he gasped. "A pardon from General Washington." The officer took the paper and read it aloud. "Unbind the prisoner and let him go," he commanded of his only enemy. Michael Whitman, with his head bowed upon his breast, went forth a free man and a changed man. The power of Christian charity had rescued him from a shameful death, and the cause of patriotism need have no further fears of being harmed by him. Scene 4. Although Washington had no children of his own, he adopted the widow Custis's two children and loved them as their father. While the shouts of triumph were heard at the surrender of Yorktown, word came to Washington that his stepson, who he loved dearly and who had been serving as an aide to the commander-in-chief, had fallen ill of camp fever in the trenches before Yorktown. When the doctor announced there was no longer hope, Washington, attended by a single officer and a groom, left his headquarters at midnight and rode with all speed 30 miles to where his stepson lay. The anxious watchers of the dying were, in the gray of the twilight, aroused by a trampling of a horse, and looking out, discovered the commander-in-chief alighting from his horse in the courtyard. He immediately summoned Dr. Craik. "Is there any hope?" Craik mournfully shook his head. The general retired to a room to indulge his grief, requesting to be left alone. In a little while, the poor sufferer expired. Washington, tenderly embracing the bereaved wife and mother, observed to the weeping group around the remains of him he so dearly loved, "From this moment I adopt his two youngest children as my own." Absorbed in grief, he then waved his hand a melancholy adieu, and, fresh horse being ready, without rest or refreshment, he remounted and returned to camp. Scene 5. In his retirement, Mount Vernon was frequented by guests and visitors. A Mr. Elkanah Watson visited in the winter of 1785. He says, "I trembled with awe as I came into the presence of this great man. I found him at table with Mrs. Washington and his private family, and he put me at my ease in a free and affable conversation." In the evening, Mr. Watson sat conversing for a full hour with Washington after all the family had retired. Mr. Watson had taken a severe cold in the course of a harsh winter journey and coughed excessively. Washington pressed him to take some remedies, but he declined. After retiring for the night, his coughing increased. "When some time had elapsed," writes he, "the door of my room was gently opened, and on drawing my bed curtains, I beheld Washington himself, standing at my bedside with a bowl of hot tea in his hand. I was mortified and distressed beyond expression. This little incident occurring in common life with an ordinary man would not have been noticed, but as a trait of the benevolence and private virtue of Washington deserves to be recorded." How about a couple of more? Scene 6. Immediately after the organization of the present government, the chief magistrate repaired to Fredericksburg to pay humble duty to his mother, preparatory to his departure for New York. Seeing how disease had ravaged her body, he said that as soon as he could tend to necessary business of the new government, he would hasten back to Virginia to see her. She interrupted him with, "You will see me no more. My great age and the disease which is fast approaching my vitals warn me that I shall not be long in this world. I trust in God that I may be somewhat prepared for a better. But go, George. Fulfill the high destinies which heaven appears to have intended for you. Go, my son. and may heaven's and a mother's blessing be with you always. The president was deeply affected. His head rested upon the shoulder of his parent, whose aged arm feebly yet fondly encircled his neck. That brow on which fame had wreathed the purest laurel virtue ever gave to created man relaxed from its awful bearing. That look which would have awed a Roman senate was bent in filial tenderness upon the time-worn features of the aged matron. He wept. Scene 7. Washington's last days, like those that preceded them in the course of a long and well-spent life, were devoted to constant and careful employment. His correspondence, both at home and abroad, was immense, yet no letter was unanswered. One of the best bred men of his time, Washington deemed it a grave offense against the rules of good manners and propriety to leave letters unanswered. He wrote with great facility, and it would be a difficult matter to find another who had written so much, who had written so well. General Harry Lee once observed to him, "We are amazed, sir, at the vast amount of work you get through." Washington answered, "Sir, I rise at 4 o'clock, and a great deal of my work is done while others sleep." And the final scene I'll share for now took place exactly 218 years ago today, on December 14th, 1799. Washington was just 67 years old and had taken a ride around his beautiful Mount Vernon property that he loved so much on December 12th. An eyewitness wrote, "Soon after he went out, the weather became very bad, rain, hail, and snow falling alternately with a cold wind. I observed to him that I was afraid he had got wet. He said no, his great coat had kept him dry. He came to dinner without changing his dress. In the evening, he appeared as well as usual. A heavy fall of snow took place on Friday, which prevented the general from riding out as usual. He had taken cold and complained of a sore throat. He, however, went out in the afternoon to mark some trees that were to be cut down. He had a hoarseness which increased in the evening, but he made light of it. He sat in the parlor with Mrs. Washington and myself reading until about 9 o'clock. He was very cheerful, and when he met with anything interesting or entertaining, he would read it aloud as well as his hoarseness would permit him. On his retiring, I observed to him that he had better take something to remove his cold. He answered, 'No, you know I never take anything for a cold. Let it go as it came.' Between 2 and 3 o'clock on Saturday morning, he awoke Mrs. Washington and told her he was very unwell. She observed that he could scarcely speak and breathed with difficulty, and would have got up to call a servant, but he would not permit her lest she should take cold. The doctor was summoned in the morning, and despite applying remedies, his condition worsened rapidly. By the afternoon, Washington said, 'I find I am going. My breath cannot last long. I believed from the first that the disorder would prove fatal.' He gave instructions to his assistant to arrange his papers, accounts, and books, and asked if there was anything which it was essential for him to do, as he had but a very short time to continue among us. His assistant said, 'I told him I could recollect nothing, but that I hoped he was not so near his end.' He observed, smiling, that he certainly was, and that it was the debt that all must pay. He looked to the event with perfect resignation. As the evening came on, he said to his physicians, 'I feel myself going. I thank you for your attentions, but I pray you to take no more trouble about me. Let me go off quietly. I cannot last long.' About 10 minutes before he expired, between 10 and 11 o'clock at night, his breathing became easier. He lay quietly. He withdrew his hand from mine and felt his own pulse. I saw his countenance change. I spoke to Dr. Craik, who sat by the fire. He came to the bedside. The general's hand fell from his wrist. I took it in mine and put it into my bosom. Dr. Craik put his hands over his eyes, and he expired without a struggle or a sigh. While we were fixed in silent grief, Mrs. Washington, who was sitting at the foot of the bed, asked with a firm and collected voice, Is he gone? I could not speak, but held up my hand as a signal that he was no more. 'Tis well, said she in the same voice. All is now over. I shall soon follow him. I have no more trials to pass through. She joined him just 2.5 years later. The sublimest figure in American history is Washington on his knees at Valley Forge. He was in that hour and place the American people personified, not depending on their own courage or goodness, but asking aid from God, their Father and Preserver. Washington knew that morals are priceless, but he knew that morals are from within, and he knew that in that dread day when all, save courage, had forsaken the American arms, appeal must be made to that power beyond ourselves, eternal in the heavens, which, after all, in every crisis of the lives of men and nations, has been their surest source of strength. That is why the snows of Valley Forge, his altar, and on his knees, asked aid from him whom the enemy had forgotten. The enemy trusted in numbers and munitions, in infantry, cavalry, artillery. Washington trusted in those things too, but he also trusted in the God of men and nations. And Washington won. With his lean, ragged levies, undismayed, he crouched among the vigilant hills, a show to the disdainful, heaven-blinded foe. Unlauded, unsupported, disobeyed, thwarted, maligned, conspired against, betrayed. Yet nothing could unheart him. Wouldst thou know his secret? There, in that thicket of snow, Washington knelt before his God and prayed. Bye-bye. See you next time.